Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. It may be getting too cold for a lot of commercial or household projects involving excavating, but if you're planning to do any digging between now and next spring or beyond, you're going to want to hear about a brand new educational resource and certification program from Call Before You Dig that'll help you ensure any deep dig projects you're planning in the future at home or on the job roll out safely. Then we'll clue you in on new job opportunities that are opening up in the new year with a panel of guests digging into the state's first ever clean energy and green jobs study produced through the Joint Committee of the Energy Efficiency Board and the Connecticut Green Bank Board of Directors. And we'll close introducing you to Recovery Network of Programs, a private nonprofit social service agency which has been serving the greater Bridgeport community since 1972, restoring hope, health, and well-being for individuals and families in a recovery environment. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Are you decorating with holiday candles? Well, then consider the flameless kind, as December is the peak month for candle fires. The risk is so common that nearly one-third of us have left the room or fallen asleep while burning candles, according to a 2020 American Red Cross survey. So if you must use candles, never leave them unattended. Keep them away from anything that could burn and place them out of reach from children and pets. The American Red Cross in Connecticut also urges everyone to follow Red Cross decorating safety tips to prevent fires and injuries. For more information, including ways to create a fire escape plan to practice with your family, visit redcross.org/fire. Well, today we're welcoming back an organization that we would typically hear from either in the March, April timeframe, and then tend to circle back and remind you of sometime around August 11th, 8/11. And that is because 811 is the number you dial to get Call Before You Dig services. And maybe you're saying, well, why are we hearing about Call Before You Dig just as the ground is starting to anticipate getting frozen for the winter? Well, we're here to meet Anthony Willeman. He's the Call Before You Dig call center manager, to talk a little bit about a brand new offering for businesses, excavators, homeowners, landscapers, and, well, you'll find out all the folks that can benefit from these services. In cooperation with Pelican Corp, a little over a month ago, Call Before You Dig announced the launch of Education Access, which is an e-learning program for the Call Before You Dig 811 service. So we're going to learn all about that with Anthony. And Anthony, hey, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, let's circle back because, you know, people are saying, oh, isn't this something, you know, why are we hearing about Call Before You Dig here as we're just moving toward wintertime, where presumably there wouldn't be a lot of, you know, landscape excavation, people putting up fences and mailboxes, digging new swimming pools and things like that.
Sure. You bring up a really good point, John. Considering the ground is getting harder and less excavation does happen in the winter months, it's a great opportunity to educate your employees, and excavators have this chance to gain this education and as a reminder through their off time.
Mm-hmm. So it also it would provide some important guidance to even, you know, casual folks that are maybe planning a project around their house or maybe getting in on some of the last few days of pleasant weather and unfrozen ground, maybe to make that fence post repair or do some other kind of landscape prep.
Absolutely. So the education course that we provide is free and offered to anybody that wants to take it. It includes a lot of good information for not only homeowners, but excavators and the utilities. And to expand that information and what you need to understand about the Call Before You Dig program, even as a homeowner and hiring contractors to do work, it's good for them to have an understanding of the regulations, the rules that they need to follow, so that those contractors are doing what they're supposed to.
Great. Well, let's stop you right there and kind of roll the chapter back a little bit to help folks understand and remind those who may not have heard one of our latest rounds of broadcasts or announcements about Call Before You Dig about this program. It does have a nationwide implications, but Connecticut was really among, if not one of the first states to implement this practice after a tragedy that happened right here in the Naugatuck Valley, right?
Absolutely. So in the 1980s, there was an incident in Derby, Connecticut, where a gas line was damaged. That gas was escaping and backed up into a building that actually had a restaurant that was open and doing business. That gas eventually found an ignition source and exploded. There were several fatalities in that incident and several more injured, and it was a real learning experience for not only Connecticut, but like you said, the nation as a whole. So immediately, Call Before You Dig efforts were made in Connecticut to establish us as an organization so that excavators can communicate with utilities when they're digging in the ground.
And since then, this program, as you mentioned, has really expanded nationwide. And 811 is now sort of almost as universally known, especially among commercial contractors and landscapers and folks that do excavation, as 911 is or 411 is to regular household members. Right?
You're absolutely right. So as time went on, and more states kind of pulled into the Call Before You Dig model, they kind of came together and put their heads together to come up with a number, the 811 number, as a nationally recognized contact number that you can use for Call Before You Dig services alike.
Well, what do people need to know about Call Before You Dig as it stands today? Because this is no longer an option, and violating the Call Before You Dig situation, especially in the case that you do happen to strike and damage some sort of underground utility, no longer just goes with some sort of a warning or a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, the main thing that I really like to educate people with, and especially ones that have never heard about Call Before You Dig or know very little about them, is that it's a free service. It's a service that we provide as to make a communication link between somebody that's going to be digging in the ground and to the utilities that own assets in the ground. So Call Before You Dig, we don't actually go out and do the markings, and I think that's one thing that's really misunderstood about the program as a whole. But again, we really serve as that communication link. We're here to answer a phone call or take a ticket that's processed through our e-ticket system online, and then communicate all of that information to the utilities directly. Those utilities directly will communicate back to you in either marking those underground assets or potentially clearing the area of conflict.
So does that mean that if a homeowner or a contractor does their due diligence and makes that 811 call in Connecticut to Call Before You Dig, they may actually see more than one utility representative marking utility lines? Or is that all kind of done through a clearinghouse or a contractor and only one person comes out to make those markings?
Yeah, so good question. Connecticut has several utility owners in our state, and there's one that's a contract locator. A contract locator is a hired vendor from the utility, so the contract locator might go out and mark out a few different utilities at one time, but then you would have other municipalities that would come in that are not covered by those contractors. So essentially, depending on the area that you're in, if you're in a more rural area, you probably have less utilities. If you live, you know, maybe in some city limits or bigger cities like Hartford or New Haven, you're going to see a lot more utilities on your ticket and more people coming from those utilities to mark out their assets.
Well, Anthony, as the Call Before You Dig call center manager, have you been doing this for quite a while?
I have. Well, I've been a manager for almost 5 years now. And even before that, I was actually in the call center answering phone calls and worked my way up as a supervisor.
So do you kind of anecdotally think that it's more important than ever to continue to remind people about call before you dig? Because over the past 5+ years that you've been working for the organization, a lot of people may be moving into or relocating to new homes where they might not even know if utility lines exist going into or out of their property, or at least where they are.
Sure. Great point, John. That's one thing that I think my neighbors during the spring and summertime, they kind of got sick of me reminding them if they were going to be digging in the ground to call before you dig. And it's something that I do even more than just in my neighborhood. I've always educated contractors from ones that are digging, landscapers or a utility excavator. Educating them is one of the joys that I really find in being the call center manager. Mm-hmm. And that I hope that loops us right back around to education access.
Yeah, I was going to say, now you've been replaced by a machine.
And that's okay with me, because we're still going to do the in-person education at
counseling,
some point,
sure.
Hopefully when we get through this pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. So what's going on with this new video program? How did this come together?
Sure. So Call Before You Dig, we've actually been talking about this for a little bit. And getting into 2020, it was going to be one of our focuses. It just coincidentally came just before a pandemic hit us. Mm-hmm. And that really put a catalyst behind our efforts to really get this education access online and available to people.
And this was something that did not come at a cost to utility ratepayers or even Call Before You Dig, right? This was something supported by a grant?
It was. So we have a federal grant that's called, it's our PHMSA grant. So that was supplied to us. We Call Before You Dig applies for these grants, and these grants are done, you know, throughout the state. It's not just Call Before You Dig, that organization that benefits from it. It's other One Calls, they participate in those grants as well. And essentially we just kind of outline what kind of funds we would need and what we're trying to do with it. And they've been so gracious to be able to help fund this effort to make an education access.
Hmm. So I imagine you have previewed, if not frequently recommended in the past few weeks, the excavator education course. Tell us more about it and what people can expect to see and learn when they sign up to take that module.
Yeah, education access, it's readily available on the Call Before You Dig website, so cbyd.com. If you go to that website, you'll see a tab towards the middle of the page that says excavator education. So going there, again, it's a free service that we provide, so it doesn't cost you anything. You can register there, and it's an easy platform that you can use as you go through some interactive chapters. It goes from, you know, an overview of Call Before You Dig organization and where we originated from and where we're at now, and then going through the e-ticket process and how to submit a ticket online or calling into the center. We touch on education of working around gas lines and other utilities, as well as rounding out all of the regulations that we educate on and best practices that come around the Call Before You Dig program.
And although you call it an excavator education course, for folks that may not have been on the interview early on, it's for anybody who's really digging in the ground much more below the level of, say, you know, replanting a potted plant or something, right?
Sure. So, I mean, even using myself as an example, I've honestly never been an excavator myself, but I have all this knowledge and I'm able to educate other people when I see the opportunity present itself. So if it's utility personnel, and you might not be an excavator at the utility employer that you work for, but having that information and having the knowledge behind Call Before You Dig helps. You might do other parts of your job and planning an excavation or working with the excavators that do that at your company. Even being a homeowner and hiring a contractor, like I mentioned before, it's good information for a homeowner to have, especially if there's a larger project, you know, the putting in a swimming pool or something like that. That's something that's good knowledge that they can use and, you know, potentially quiz their contractors and making sure they're doing what they're supposed to and having a call before you dig ticket.
And the fact that, you know, especially now coming into the winter season, a lot more folks in the trades and such, as well as homeowners, may have a lot more time on their hands. So this is a great way for them to kind of study up in their pajamas or on a weekend or on an evening when nothing else is going on. And I guess it's a program that you don't have to just view once. Once you register for it, you can look it up again as a reminder once spring starts rolling around.
Yes, thanks for hitting on that, because the platform that we've built it off of allows you to start and stop at your own pace. So if you don't have the entire 3 hours, which is about what it takes to go through the program, if you don't have 3 hours right then to dedicate it, you know, you can do a half hour at a time or even an hour chunk of it. And yes, sitting at home and being able to do it, you know, while sitting comfortably on your couch, is a good option.
Great. Well, in closing, Anthony, I guess anyone in business, large or small, is always looking to keep their company top of mind with the consumers that may use them. And that being said, for those who are in more commercial and landscaping and excavating businesses, I would imagine being able to add to their marketing that they're a certified call before you dig excavator education certified vendor gives them a little bit of a leg up or a promotional gold star as they are trying to compete with others for business.
Yeah, I think if any time an excavator can promote that they are following the rules and they have the knowledge for call before you dig safety, that's absolutely a leg up.
Very good. Well, Anthony, I really appreciate you taking the time this morning. Anthony Willemain is the Call Before You Dig call center manager, and we're talking about their new Call Before You Dig online education access programs. The excavator education course is available now, which covers all kinds of business, including the one call rules, regulations, safe digging practices, and more. And it ensures that a consistent message is delivered to all users. This is a straightforward, interactive presentation that's engaging and provides certification upon successful completion of the curriculum. If you need to know more, just go to Call Before You Dig. That's CBYD.com. And we'll leave you at that. Anthony, thank you so much for your time this morning, and have a great and safe holiday.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Well, regular listeners to the program, especially over the past couple of years, have heard a lot of PSAs and promotion, as well as some interviews with representatives of the Connecticut Green Bank. And we've got another one on the line today, along with a panel that includes Philip Jordan. He's vice president at BW Research. Brian Farnan is here. He's general counsel and chief legal officer for the Connecticut Green Bank. And Matthew Krizik is here. He's an associate economist with the Connecticut Department of Labor. They've all joined me to discuss Connecticut's latest clean energy industry jobs report, which was recently released and is the first clean energy jobs report in Connecticut. This is most exciting for a couple of reasons, and I'm so excited you guys are all able to join me on the line here. Certainly, anything that kind of foretells the prospect of greater job opportunities is a huge priority right now, given the massive amount of job losses due to the virus, but also the prospect that a lot of the economic recovery, particularly based on some of the initiatives that President-elect Joe Biden has introduced, involve green jobs and energy initiatives. So a lot to talk about, and the fact that this is the first clean energy jobs report in Connecticut really puts a stake in the ground and gives folks like you and me a great foundation to build on as we revisit the these reports, which I'll assume will be updated regularly. But before we dive into the clean energy industry, Matt, your resource is really important in being able to provide an overview of where Connecticut's economy is today. We're taping this only 3 or 4 days before we air the program, so this is the latest best information. Talk to us a little bit about how we're looking right now in Connecticut, Matt.
First off, thanks to John for having me. A quick overview of the U.S. economy and the Connecticut economy. Obviously, COVID has impacted every sector of the economy in Connecticut overall. Employment peaked in February, fell to a low in April. As of October, total employment is at 94% of peak levels. Mm-hmm. The rebound has been generally swift, given the impact on the global economy. When compared to the U.S., Connecticut has had a larger initial employment decline, but as of October, it's at 94% of peak levels, whereas the U.S. is at 93%. Industries in Connecticut most impacted by COVID include accommodation food services, retail trade, arts, entertainment, and recreation, industries where you can't really work remotely. As of October, some industries have regained actually a larger percentage of their employment than the state economy overall, including transportation, warehousing, finance and insurance, manufacturing, construction, and healthcare. Wholesale trade is actually above peak levels. Sectors with slower recoveries include accommodation, food services, arts and entertainment and recreation, and administrative and support. General other good indicators are that unemployment has been declining for the past few months, and job openings are back up to around where they were before COVID.
Now, Matt, we heard earlier this week that there's a little bit of a rebound in the jobless numbers nationwide. Your latest best numbers show that things have bounced back and remained fairly static in the past few weeks in Connecticut.
I think you'd be referring to claims data, but the monthly unemployment numbers that that I've looked at, I'm pulling it up now. Hmm. It's been a steady decline since about mid-year.
Hmm. And anecdotally, I know that you don't have a lot of that data at your fingertips, but when you look across those four sectors, accommodation and food services, retail, trade, arts, entertainment, and recreation, and administrative and support, do you have some ballpark idea of where that package of employers stands in the greater fabric of jobs across Connecticut? Is it a fractional number of people who have been affected, or is it a much more substantial sector of the Connecticut workforce?
Well, certainly those are large sectors of the Connecticut economy, but I think the important thing to focus on is that, the vaccine's on the way, the shutdown we had earlier this year had a large initial impact, but basically in the past few months, like, the trajectory has been positive. Overall employment's going down. We're well on the way to recovery, generally, I would say.
Excellent. Gentlemen, let me put a quick question to each of you to get things rolling in regards to green jobs and the clean energy industry. And that is with the affirmation that President-elect Joe Biden will be taking office in just a few weeks. Talk to me from each of your perspectives on how you see the energy and promotion he has been putting behind energy related, in particular, green jobs, as a major platform of his restoration of the national economy, and presumably that will roll up or roll down to Connecticut. How does the Biden factor play when you're looking out over the next 12 months to 4 years? Phil, why don't you let me know what you think about that?
Sure. Well, again, thanks for having me on your program. I do think the Biden presidency will be significant for the clean energy sector across the U.S. Whether or not he'll be able to get a $2 trillion climate plan as he's proposed through a divided Senate, if it remains so after the Georgia runoff, remains to be seen. Obviously, $2 trillion climate plan would create an enormous number of jobs in a short period of time, largely around infrastructure. But even without an ambitious spending plan of that magnitude, a Biden presidency would certainly be redoubling commitments to decarbonization. And that would have a lot of impacts through everything from research and development funding, professional services, and, of course, construction and manufacturing jobs. So it's really hard to understate just how significant some of these initial changes, even without the most comprehensive and most ambitious climate plans, could have on job creation across the U.S. and certainly within Connecticut.
Right. Brian, anything to add?
Sure. So, I mean, I think you're starting to already see some of that positive effect. You look at a company like Fuel Cell Energy, a Connecticut fuel cell manufacturer,
yep, Denver,
their stock price is going through the roof, which is great news. From a Green Bank perspective, we were passed with bipartisan support, and now the talk and likelihood of a national Green Bank is even much more likely. So we think it's going to be positive for the clean energy movement overall.
Great. Matt, any perspective on your end in terms of the promise of a push for green jobs nationwide and how that might reflect on Connecticut?
What I could reference is that the U.S. Department of Labor does 10-year projections through 2029, and two of the fastest growing occupations are solar panel installers and wind turbine technicians. Mm-hmm. They're both projected to grow by over 50%. These numbers were released in September, before, political certainty.
Yes.
But what it does show is that, they're small occupations because they're kind of newer industries, mm-hmm. and newer occupations, but they are projected to grow significantly.
Great. So this first of its kind green jobs report that was recently published assessed the industry impact over the past 5 years. Brian, can you give listeners some background on why why green jobs and the clean energy industry is so important here in Connecticut, and how you see it will impact our economy and our workforce?
Sure. Thanks, John. So, I mean, prior to COVID, the clean energy industry was in Connecticut was really seeing strong growth. In reality, it was one of the few real bright spots for job growth in Connecticut. And then since 2015, we've made steady progress building the industry. Connecticut continues to be a leader when it comes to policy innovation in this sector. And as many of you are aware, clean energy delivers positive impacts for society, and especially think of our small businesses and vulnerable communities. 2019, our investment in clean energy, I think it reached over 260,000 customers in Connecticut, and reducing that energy burden is so important. You have to think of it this way. Connecticut is in competition with every other state in the union and globally to attract businesses and get ahead. And these programs can really help make us a more competitive state.
Great. Phil, give us a little bit more background about the study and the clean energy workforce landscape across the state.
Sure, John. Well, first, I think it's important to point out that this is the first joint job study in Connecticut, as Connecticut joins its neighbors in Massachusetts and Rhode Island and New York in tracking clean energy jobs annually. So I think that's really exciting and great news.
Mm-hmm.
The report was produced by the Connecticut Green Bank, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, Eversource, United Illuminating, Southern Connecticut Gas, and Connecticut Natural Gas, which are subsidiaries of Evergrid, Inc. And this was operating through the Joint Committee of the Energy Efficiency Board, or the EEB, and, of course, the Connecticut Green Bank Board of Directors. So, I think it's really important to point out the key stakeholders who are who are behind this effort in order to make it happen.
Very good. Hey, I want to just pause you there for a second, Phil, because we want to take a quick break and come back and talk about the BW Research's role and their analysis and some of the key takeaways from the report and the key findings. Let's do that as soon as we come back. We're so pleased to be talking about this first of its kind Connecticut Clean Energy and Green Jobs Report with Matt Krizik from the Connecticut Department of Labor, Philip Jordan, who is a VP at BW Research, and Brian Barnin, Chief Legal Officer at the Connecticut Green Bank. Stay with us. We'll be right back to talk more about a possible green job or energy job in your future. Stay with us. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Boquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The COVID-19 pandemic has dramatically increased demand for pets as people seek adding a pet to the family to ease the loneliness and tension of prolonged time at home. With this rising demand has come a spike in pet scams in which an online search ends with a would-be pet owner paying hundreds of dollars or more to purchase a pet that ultimately doesn't exist. Better Business Bureau advises extreme caution when shopping for a pet online, especially in light of scammers' evolving tactics, and they offer this advice. See the pet in person before paying any money. In light of the pandemic, consider a video call with the seller so you can see the seller and the actual pet for sale. Do a reverse image search of the photo that they're showing of the pet. Or do research and get a sense of a fair price for the breed you're considering. And before considering purchasing a new pet, check out a local animal shelter online for pets you can meet before adopting who would love a second chance at being your new best friend. Well, we're back. Thanks for sticking around. Maybe you're interested in what this first of its kind report here in Connecticut shows in terms of prospects for you in the green job and clean energy workforce of Connecticut's future. Before we went on the break, we heard a little bit about the key stakeholders in this project. But let's talk a little bit about some of the analysis that BW Research was able to deliver for this project. Philip.
Thanks. And so when we look at the clean energy sector, I think it's important to sort of segment out the major technology areas that we're talking about. So within clean energy, we're talking about some large segments, right, like energy efficiency or clean energy generation, alternative transportation, mm-hmm. clean grid and storage, and clean fuels. So these are obviously a broad swath of categories, and Connecticut has strength across all of these technology areas. We actually found that more than 44,000 people worked in clean energy in Connecticut at the end of 2019. And as Brian mentioned, a real hot spot of growth in the economy. That's up 9.1% from 2015. Wow. In total, clean energy jobs accounted for 2.6% of all jobs and a gross state product of $6.5 billion for the state in 2019. So it's obviously a large and rapidly growing sector. At least, you know, these data were all from pre-COVID, and we'll get into some more of the COVID impacts in just a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to the jobs data itself, we also detail clean energy employment by value chain segment. So that's whether someone works in construction or manufacturing or for utilities. We looked at clean energy wages, wage premiums, what difficulties employers have finding workers, geographic opportunity zones, and demographic distribution of clean energy workers compared to state and nationwide averages. So just a couple of key findings that I'll note in addition to the big number of the 44,000 people working in the sector. Nearly 80% of the jobs in clean energy work in energy efficiency. It's also seen the greatest growth since 2017, creating more than 1,250 new jobs in Connecticut. Generation, clean energy generation, is the second largest sector, which is 4,830 workers in Connecticut, with a 6.2% growth rate from 2017 to 2019. Hmm. And most of those jobs are in solar and also in nuclear.
Okay.
The jobs pay more. So we found for entry-level workers, 92% of occupations paid a premium for working in clean energy over their sort of non-clean energy counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
And Connecticut has a higher than average concentration of veterans in the industry. And that's for both statewide workforce overall and the national clean energy industry average. So doing a great job in Connecticut employing veterans.
Excellent. Well, let me say. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was just going to make a final note that women and Hispanic or Latinx and Black or African American workers are underrepresented compared to the overall averages.
Well, Brian, can you kind of pick up the thread on that and tell us a little bit more about how clean energy is impacting vulnerable communities and what's available to them, as well as prospects for small businesses?
Sure. Let's talk about small businesses and vulnerable communities. That's a great idea. So when you think about energy costs, they have a huge impact on any small business. And there's a program, it's called Small Business Energy Advantage Program. If anyone is interested or has a small business, just Google Energy CT and put in small business. You'll find it. And it's a great program. And these programs are really important because, as I said earlier, Connecticut is in competition with surrounding states. And we want to, you know, support our local small businesses. They have the greatest impact on our local economy and job creation. And similarly, low and moderate income households are also burdened at energy costs at a higher rate than wealthier residents because those costs are such a larger just portion of their income. We have a program, it's called Home Energy Solution, HESS for short,
mm-hmm.
and there's an income eligibility component to that so that, you know, they'll come in, they'll do an energy audit to find ways to bring down people's energy bills, and that program goes a long way to, you know, hopefully relieve some of that energy burden on low to moderate income residents in Connecticut. And I would just say lastly, you know, very proud of the fact that Connecticut is at parity when it comes to low to moderate income families and beyond parity when it comes to communities of color for demanding solar PV. So, and those are great opportunities for people to put a little extra money in their pocket as opposed to shelving out more for their energy bill.
Excellent. In terms of the COVID impact, let's wrap it up with that. We've got about 3 minutes left, a minute or so for each of the three of you. What are the negative effects of COVID-19 in the government shutdown in regards to the green sector and energy jobs, fellas?
Well, I can start here. The report itself briefly looks at the negative impacts of COVID-19. With about 6,500 industry job losses in March, April, or May. The projection is now to be slightly below at year end to be slightly below pre-pandemic totals. In fact, losing a couple of years of those gains. I just would also note that COVID has impacted communities of color much more significantly, not only in terms of public health, but also economically. And so it's really important to address issues of equitable growth as we come out of this pandemic. So I applaud you for talking about vulnerable communities on your program and for the Green Bank and its partners for focusing so heavily on these issues of equity.
Great. Let's wrap it up with Brian. Any additional thoughts, Brian, or references for people so they can look at the report themselves?
Sure. They can find it online at the Connecticut Green Bank's website. And I mean, I would just say at the end of the day, you know, a robust clean energy workforce is essential so that we can deliver energy efficiency and renewable energy programs to ratepayers, those who are paying electricity bills. And at the end of the day, it's all about jobs, jobs, jobs. You know, mm-hmm. especially with COVID, these are good paying jobs. These are jobs that can't be outsourced. So it's very important that we build this industry within Connecticut.
Excellent. Great to talk with you, and exciting to consider the prospects of this sort of magical meeting between the initiatives that are happening here in Connecticut, as it fits in as a small puzzle piece to what promises to be a much greater focus on clean energy and green jobs under the incoming Biden presidency. According to a recent Connecticut Clean Energy Industry report, more than 44,000 people, an increase of a little over 9% from 2015, make up Connecticut's clean energy workforce. And this brand new report signals how those numbers are sure to be ticking up in the future. I want to thank our guest this morning for talking about this first of its kind Connecticut Clean Energy Jobs Report, Matthew Krizik with the Connecticut Department of Labor, Philip Jordan, a VP at BW Research that played a huge role in crunching the numbers to produce this report, and of course the agency that delivered it, and their chief legal officer Brian Barnin, and I'm talking about at the Connecticut Green Bank. Thanks for all of you for your information and resource this morning, and best of luck in the new year in seeing all this promise carried out, gentlemen. Have a happy and safe holiday, and we'll see you in 2021. Well, I have to say, I've had many thousands of guests on the award-winning For the People over the past almost 30 years, but very few of them have been waiting so long to be on the show than all my new friends that I'm making this morning at Recovery Network of Programs. This is a private nonprofit social service agency which has been serving the greater Bridgeport community since 1972, restoring hope, health, and well-being for individuals and families in a recovery environment that embraces compassion, dignity, and respect. And these days, with the additional burdens of COVID, all of that is all the more important. And we're going to hear about all their great work and some of the programs and assistance they might be able to offer you or somebody you love. Jennifer Kolakowski is with us. She's CEO. Moira Rizzo, great to meet you. She's Chief Clinical Officer. Matt Gazzetti's on the line. He's the Department Director at medication-assisted treatment at RNP. And Danielle Levesque is here. She's the Director of Recovery Services. So let's bring it all back to Jennifer Kolakowski, the boss, the CEO. Jennifer, tell us a little bit more about Recovery Network of Programs.
Great. Thank you, John. And thank you. We're so happy for this opportunity, grateful to be speaking with you. So RNP is an amazing organization that serves nearly 3,000 individuals on a daily basis through 24 different programs. And we've been serving Fairfield County for nearly 50 years. We're in our 48th year and sort of looking at our 50th year of how to celebrate all of our milestones, accomplishments, and contributions to our community. So, how we are organized in terms of the services that we have, and I should say one of the most unique aspects of Recovery Network of Programs is that we do have 24 programs and that we have the ability to pivot and change on at a moment's notice when an individual's circumstances changes so that we can provide any number of services. And so we have a number of different housing opportunities for individuals who may need emergency, transitional, or permanent housing. We have two residential treatment facilities for individuals who have both a mental health and a substance use disorder. We have three different locations for outpatient services, all of which are duly licensed. And in other words, they are able to treat individuals who have both a mental health and substance use disorder.
And where are
and
they?
Two of those three all in Bridgeport, okay. In various parts of Bridgeport.
Gotcha.
We try to make ourselves as accessible as possible.
But your service area is, is a multi-town.
It is.
Great.
It absolutely is.
Okay.
And some of our programs draw from across the state because we are the only, particular provider or provider of that level of care or program. So
I
we
see.
Do get referrals from across the state.
Great. Well, Jennifer, let
and
me
then
ask
we
you.
Have,
oh, I'm sorry.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Sure.
Please finish.
So we also have a detox facility over by Bridgeport Hospital, as well as what Matt will talk a little bit more about, our medication-assisted treatment programs, one of which is in Bridgeport and the other is in Stratford.
Great. Well, we've had a lot of agencies on the program throughout its history, but especially over the past year or so, talking about both providing services or support for folks in recovery. How has the Recovery Network of Programs been pivoting to the opiate epidemic during the pandemic, Jen?
Sure. So we have, you know, we've changed all of our services to make sure that we continue to maintain every level of care despite the pandemic and certainly through the opiate epidemic. And we have been providing medication-assisted treatment for over 35 years. And one of the things that we've done is we've incorporated telehealth services for all of the individuals we're serving. So right now we have essentially a hybrid model of being able to see people in person as well as providing telehealth services. So individuals can have virtual sessions, they can have virtual groups, as well as being available for weekly and sometimes daily check-in calls for the individuals that we're serving and or reaching out to during these very difficult times.
Okay. Moira, you know and I know the cocktail of various types of drugs and additives that folks grappling with addiction have been faced with, especially over the past few years, has been horrific. They're not getting what they're paying for to try to, you know, deal with the pain that they're feeling. But I understand Recovery Network of Programs has a unique overdose prevention and strategy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one of the things, you know, we've noticed, you know, we're always tracking, you know, rates of overdose, and certainly through the pandemic and what we know has been a great mental health crisis for so many people, that the overdoses in the state are exceeding last year's overdose rates for every single month except for August, and still seeing a lot of, you know, fentanyl and carfentanil and xylazine, which is an animal tranquilizer, in the overdose opiate data. So, you know, great cause for concern. So, you know, as Jen referenced, because we have so many programs and a continuum of care, I think our biggest strength is that we have this no wrong door. We have so many different touch points to reach people, right? So we have a very active, and Danielle can speak more to this, outreach team who will go to hotspots in the community where we know people have been using or are struggling or have overdoses have taken place. So we're really doing that very proactive outreach to engage people in services, right? We're not just waiting for them to come to us. And then the other thing that we do at every level of care, we are teaching overdose prevention. All of our staff is trained in overdose prevention, you know, which involves a lot, including, you know, the use of Narcan. And all of our clients who go through any of our programs at any level of care have the opportunity to get trained and leave our program with their own Narcan kit, because we know that's, you know, what's saving so many lives.
Yeah. Well, Moira, yeah. In speaking about Narcan and the fact that you're seeing, you know, a new generation of additives into the substances that that people are inhaling or injecting or otherwise taking in terms of opiates and other drugs, is Narcan remaining sort of the preventative intervention of choice, or are there now new additives that people are consuming and overdosing on that Narcan is not having the desired effect on?
Yeah, well, Narcan, I think, still is the cutting edge, you know, intervention for when someone is overdosing. As you stated, when there's fentanyl involved or carfentanil, which is 100 times stronger than fentanyl, sometimes it will take repeated, you know, administrations of Narcan to reverse the effects of the overdose and, you know, save the person. And I think that's, you know, when you look at the state data, where the overdoses are fatal, it's because those other extra additives that are so strong are involved, and that's when it leads to more fatal overdoses than just the straight opiates themselves, because the Narcan is so effective with opiates.
Great. Folks, if you just joined us getting ready for our music or talk day on our stations, we're with Recovery Network of Programs, serving the greater Bridgeport community since 1972 with the restoration of hope, health, and well-being for individuals and families in a recovery environment. Matt Gazzetti is also on the line with us, along with Danielle Levesque. We'll hear from both of them. Matt, you're the Department Director for Medication-Assisted Treatment. This is a huge component and very successful, I understand. Tell us more about your work and the work that you're delivering to your clients through the medication-assisted treatment initiative.
Well, we have two programs. We have one in Bridgeport that's called Cancelo Treatment Center, where we serve approximately 800 clients. And then we have another one in Stratford, the Center for Human Services, and we serve close to 900 clients there. We give them methadone to deal with their opioid dependence. And not only do we provide medication for them, but we also provide group, individual therapy, family counseling, psychiatric services. We have added support for clients who have infectious diseases through our Ryan White program. And for any client who's really struggling, we offer intensive outpatient programs at both clinics where a client can come for 3 hours a day, 3 days a week, and also get added individual therapy as needed. And then for anyone who's really struggling, we also have our other programs, our inpatient and our detox, where they can get transferred into those programs. So it's all-inclusive within Recovery Network of Programs. One other thing that we also do is we also have another medicated-assisted treatment clinic, and that's actually in Bridgeport Correctional Center. It's called our North Star Recovery Program. And right now we're serving over 50 inmates with methadone or buprenorphine. And by the spring of 2021, we expect to serve up to 100 clients. And we'll also be having Vivitrol as a medication to help deal with opioid dependence. But one of the key things about this program is that we're not only serving the clients while they're incarcerated. We've got an aftercare program where when someone gets released from jail, we're going to continue to work with those clients to make sure that they get treatment outside of jail and continue to get services like housing, job placement, health care, whether it's with us at RMP or anywhere in the state, so that we can help them live successful lives and lower the recidivism rates statewide and keep our community safe.
And I guess that's where Recovery Network of Programs coaching comes in as a key component to success. Danielle Levesque, Director of Recovery Services, we're going to wrap it up with you. We've got a couple of minutes. Give us a quick eye view into the work you're doing and why this outreach and recovery coaching is such a critical component after the initial contact with the individual seeking recovery.
Thank you, John. It's such a critical component to have people who have been through what you've been through. They're supporting you and guiding you and connecting you to resources and just there to be that peer level of support. And we just hired our 11th coach. I believe we are the only program in the state that has that many recovery coaches. So it's really important when we're doing outreach for us to identify as people in recovery, which I am myself very grateful to be, and very grateful to be working at RMP, who supports peer support roles more than anyone I have ever really encountered, especially in the state. So I know when I was, you know, going through my struggles, when I was able to have that example of someone who had overcome it, who I knew was in my corner, it made all the difference.
Yeah, I get
So that's something we really believe in, that Recovery Network of Programs is providing that, you know, that peer support and that connection to all of our clients.
Yeah, I guess being able to look to an individual who's walked in their shoes really makes all the difference in the world, as well as all of the other myriad offerings that you guys at Recovery Network of Programs offer, a really, really comprehensive number of services. And we're so pleased to be able to highlight them with the four of you this morning. A Recovery Network of Programs is a private nonprofit social service agency serving the greater Bridgeport community since 1972, restoring hope, health, and well-being for individuals and families in the recovery environment. Our guests this morning were Danielle Levesque, Director of Recovery Services, Matt Gazzetti, the Department Director of Medication-Assisted Treatment, Moira Rizzo, Chief Clinical Officer, and their CEO, Jennifer Kolakowski. Thank you all for this orientation this morning, and we look forward to talking with you folks again. Anyone who is listening who may be grappling with addiction or living with an addiction issue in your household or in your circle of friends, consider giving Recovery Network of Programs a call. Obviously, you've heard the good work they're doing and the likelihood of success. It's recovery-programs.org to check out all of the information you need to engage this organization here in the greater Bridgeport area. Thanks, folks. Have a happy and safe holiday, and we'll talk to you again in the new year.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.